78-74, Rosemary K. Olvera versus the City of Milwaukee. Ralph Weber, representing American Stores, according to my notes, has 13 minutes. Thomas Gartner, representing the City of Milwaukee, has 12 minutes. You, Mr. Cotta, have, representing Ms. Olvera, have 30 minutes. And then Ms. Attorneys Weber and Gartner will share the 5 minutes in rebuttal. Okay. Mr. Weber.
May it please the court. There's three issues that we'll be, Mr. Gartner and I will be talking about today. The first is separation of powers. The second is the procedural requirements of 62.23. And the third is the notice of claim statute. I'll address the separation of powers issues, and Mr. Gartner will be dealing with the 6223 and notice of claim matters. We're here today because back in May of 1998, by a vote of 11-4, the elected representatives of the city of Milwaukee decided that it was appropriate public policy that a high-quality grocery and pharmacy retail store be placed in land that had formerly been a railroad yard and landfill. By a vote of 11-4, the elected representative said, this is the highest and best use of that land. And so the project was approved, and the project was built, and it has now been serving in a very fine manner what had been an underserved neighborhood on the near west side of the city of Milwaukee. Several neighbors were unhappy with that decision and went to court to overturn it. And what I'd like to talk about today is what I think is one of the most important issues that I've ever argued, and that is the separation of powers. And why is it that, or should it be, that the courts have the final say in every important public matter? Or is that a problem with our representative democracy? I mean, ultimately, of course, we do have a representative democracy in which we, operating with the consent of the governed, we want people to elect representatives to go and decide important public matters.
Counsel, if I may interrupt, I'm a little bit confused. As I understand, does your separation of powers argument embrace within its ambit the issue of the notice of hearings, the statutory requirement, or are you talking, when you talk about separation of powers, the issue with respect to the internal processes of the city council?
Well, the two really are blurred in Judge Fine's opinion, and what we believe he did was by not paying appropriate or not recognizing the value in deference to internal working procedures, he said, I am the one who should decide how the internal affairs of the Common Council are decided. Once he made that decision, then he concluded that, well, because this other body didn't operate its internal mechanisms correctly, and that's for me to decide, then 6223 wasn't followed. So there is a blurring of those two. And you'll hear the argument, well, you know, rules should be followed. Well, yes.
Well, you're not challenging the authority of the legislature to require notice.
Absolutely not. No, not at all.
And you're not challenging our power to require that there be notice.
Of course not. No. 6223 is there, and the city has to follow it in their zoning procedures. Our point is that only by pulling back the curtain and looking at how is this group of elected officials, how are they operating their internal procedures, can you find that 6223 wasn't followed? And Mr. Gardner will elaborate on this more, but under Herdman, 6223 says you need to give a notice, Class 2 notice, and there's concession all around that was done. And only when there is a change of sufficient significance so that new people are affected or the same people are affected in a different way, you have to start over. And that didn't happen here. Again, concession across the board that this was the same ordinance under a different number.
Mr. Weber, oftentimes notice is equated with due process, and courts find that due process requires that notice be given. How do you blend the doctrines of separation of powers on one side and due process tied to notice on the other side?
Well, again, I think you look at the context in which the notice is being given and the process that we're talking about, okay? Because the statute, of course, says you have to give this notice and that procedure must be followed. But then what is exactly the process that we're talking about here? The process that Judge Fine focused on was the process by which the Common Council said, here's how we're going to run our business. And a perhaps more extreme example is that the Common Council says, we will operate under Robert's Rules of Order. And Robert's Rules of Order say you require a second for every motion. Well, maybe there's a municipality that says, you know what, we're going to dispense with that, and we're not going to have a second on motions. We're not going to follow this aspect of Robert's Rules, even though we've adopted them elsewhere. If that's the kind of process that a court should involve itself with, then every action of that municipality, by not following Robert's Rules of Order, and therefore not following their internal mechanisms, is violating process. That's not the process under separation of powers that the courts involve themselves with. If there's a complaint about how a legislative body is running its business on a day-to-day basis, albeit as long as they're complying with the statutes and they're complying with the constitutions, and the remedy for that is not the courts, it's for people to say, let's throw the bums out. That's what representative democracy is about. That's what representation reinforcing judicial approach is all about.
Counsel, just in the separation of powers area, and I understand your argument is that we didn't violate our own procedures, that this was appropriate, but wouldn't the court be, I mean, you have separation of powers on one side, you have checks and balances on the other, checks and balances of the judicial system. Where else would they, you're suggesting that the way to solve this is that they can throw the people out. That seems, first of all, it wouldn't take care of this problem, and it seems that that's not really the way from it has worked, in my opinion. If there's been a violation of the, if there a rule violated the Constitution, for example, obviously you go to the courts.
Well, absolutely. I mean, and Marbury teaches that, you know, constitutional violation, statutory, absolutely. But we're not talking, if we're correct, we're not talking about statutory constitutional issues. We're talking about internal procedural mechanisms. And let's talk about what happens if the notion is, well, of course, as is our culture now, the courts are the final answer on everything. Well, then, what happens in the city, what happens in the Common Council, doesn't really matter. It becomes a way station to the real power brokers yourselves. And let's go through the zoning challenge process, not because we really care what the outcome is here, because after all, what we're doing is we're creating a record in the Common Council, hoping to preserve or create a procedural problem. So then we can go to the courts, who are really going to decide what the appropriate use of land at the corner of Humboldt and North is.
Counsel, as I read the Court of Appeals decision, it was a decision based on the proper notice of the hearing. And going through the decision, it distinguishes the Herdman case and then applies at the very end of the decision, speaks of the internal processes of the council, but only in the context of whether or not the new notice is required. So I don't really see that opinion as saying whether or not the council can do, or the steering committee, or the whatever committee it is, can do this or not do this, but rather the way they did it underscores rather than negates, or supports rather than negates the need for notice.
I think there's, and I understand that's what the Court of Appeals opinion talks about at the outset. We're going to decide this very narrowly. But you only get to that issue if you somehow blur the idea. I mean, Wisconsin, we're notice public hearings and all the rest, and so you want to notice every hearing. But this is, 6223 is a little different kind of notice. 6223 says that at a point in this process of changing zoning, you have to have a Class 2 notice. It's not for every public discussion during the course of this stream you have to have a Class 2 notice. So only by Judge Fine saying, as a result of their internal procedures, it was the same as starting this whole process over, could he say, therefore, a new Class 2 notice was required. It's not just for every hearing you need a Class 2 notice. So you do have to get into, how does the Milwaukee Common Council do its business? How does the process work from somebody saying, we need to make this change to Humboldt North, to the change coming before the elected representatives for an up or down vote? So you really do need to get into how they run their business.
The council, suppose the second set of ordinances had not been identical. Would there still not need to be a same subject matter, but
sure,
not identical?
Yeah, I think you look at the degree of change under Herdman. Are a new group of people being affected? Are the same people being affected, albeit a different way? Then maybe under Herdman you need a new notice, because then it's not.
Well, who decides that
process? Well, ultimately the court would, because you would say 6223 wasn't followed. We don't have that issue here because there was no change. So, and Herdman takes this kind of common sense approach of, well, if it's the same people being affected the same way, then why would we start the process over? Isn't it just, aren't we just inviting the opportunity to say the same thing once again? Now, council said, well, but it, you know, there were some different people because this was this committee and that was that committee. But there is no requirement under law that you have the same decision makers all the way through this process. Decision makers change as elections occur and so on during the course of zoning ordinance development, which takes a significant time. And I guess one of the last points I'd like to make is that the separation of powers notion really does apply to what we're talking about here, even though it is a municipality. Your decisions, including Willow Creek last fall, talk about, you know, the zoning is legislative. It is our elected representatives deciding as a matter of public policy what is the appropriate use of this property. And then what follows in your zoning decisions when you say this is legislative? Well, you say, so we take a deferential approach. Only if you can meet this standard that we call arbitrary and capricious are we going to look beyond the substance of what our elected representatives do. So just as in the ordinary zoning review cases, by virtue of the recognition that it's legislative, you give a deferential stance. Same thing applies to what we're talking about here.
You don't think it's arbitrary and capricious to move a matter from a committee to which it's assigned that deals with zoning to another committee that doesn't deal with zoning, and then that the chair who could move that was also the chair of the steering committee, and then they get it all through, violating their own rules?
What I would say about it is politics it sometimes is a brass knuckle business. And the plaintiffs, as the respondents, as they say, hey, we were doing a great job. We only had four votes on the whole common council, but we had this thing shut down. And that kind of lobbying was great. Then the proponents, who had 11 votes, figured out a way, working within the internal procedures, to get it out of that pocket veto. Then all of a sudden, well, that's a horrible thing. Well, it's politics on both sides, and that's the way we in a representative democracy run our business. And the ultimate answer is run against them. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Whipper. Mr. Gartner?
May it please the court. This case is not about the wisdom of Milwaukee's Common Council in deciding to permit a Jewel Osco to be built. It's about the integrity of the legislative process that's followed by that council. It's about the proper interpretation of the mandatory requirements of Section 6223, the state's zoning enabling statute. And it's about the extent to which exceptions created by the courts excuse compliance with the claim statute, specifically with Section 89381B, which is the requirement that a notice of claim be filed.
Before we get into your argument, in your brief, in the appendix, you've got certified copies of ordinances.
Yes.
These were adopted after the Court of Appeals decision?
Yes, Your Honor.
And they covered this property?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if there was a reversal of the Court of Appeals, and this went back to the Common Council, what would happen?
Nothing would happen, in my view, unless the plaintiff's appellants initiated a new action to challenge the subsequent files adopted by the County Council, which were the original files that remained on file.
On what basis would they challenge it?
It seems to me that they would have to challenge the constitutionality of those two ordinances, focusing upon the impact upon their property as people owning property in the area. They may be able to raise some procedural issues, but I can't speculate as to what those might be.
And if you should succeed in reversing the Court of Appeals, what's the effect? Oh, was that the question I asked you? I'm trying to figure out my real point is this moot? I mean, I was going to put you into both situations. I forgot which one I gave you first.
You're expecting that question.
Yeah, I think you should expect it, so let's get it out of the way.
As a practical matter, I think the answer to that is probably yes.
That's what I think.
Because the Common Council has acted a second time. The current zoning permits precisely the project that exists on that property. When the mootness issue arose in the Court of Appeals, the Lake Bluff v. South Milwaukee case was raised by counsel for the plaintiff appellants, and there was some question about what remedies the courts might be able to fashion. But again, as a practical matter, I think this is moot, although the third issue dealing with the claim statute is certainly an issue of concern to the city of Milwaukee and other Wisconsin municipalities, and that issue is separate and distinct.
Counsel, the first two issues are not, well, maybe they are. Do you view them? You know, we can handle moot cases as long as they are of public interest and questions that might occur again and that this is a good time to do it. Do you think the first two issues are of that ilk?
Absent further legal proceedings under a different action, I think that they are, yes.
Counsel, as a follow-up to that, you make reference to the Court of Appeals opinion and its citation of the Lake Bluff case and that argument advanced the Court of Appeals. But the way that the Court of Appeals treated that Lake Bluff case is for the proposition that when a completion of construction in violation of a zoning code does not meet the challenge to the project. So in other words, the argument, oh, look, it's built, so even though it violated the code, the issue is moot. That's what they cited Lake Bluff for, and not on the premise of the Common Council again approving the rezoning ordinance that the Court of Appeals declared void. Do you understand the difference I'm...
Yes. Yes.
And you were asked by the chief with regard to the mootness, that is, the Common Council now another time approving the rezoning ordinances after the Court of Appeals declared them void. That's different than the moot argument addressed by the Court of Appeals, which was, it's completed, therefore it's moot.
Yes. Because the Common Council adopted those original files after the Court of Appeals decision, obviously they didn't have any knowledge.
That did very different mootness argument.
My point was that I think if the plaintiff's appellants were to focus on the first two files that were adopted and seek relief under Lake Bluff, before they could do that, they would have to challenge the second action of the Common Council after the Court of Appeals decision in rezoning the property once again to comply with the specific project that was built.
One other question on the procedures of the City Council. In the legislature, that when we would have a recalcitrant chairman, there was always the power to pull a bill from the committee. Is there such a motion that's available to the members of the council or to the president?
At the time of the actions in this case, there was not, and that was part of the problem. Following the adoption of these ordinances and the controversy over the Humboldt Yards development, the Common Council amended its own rules of procedure to change the procedures for removing a file from committee. And so today, they have the ability to vote, as the entire council has the ability to vote and to remove a file from committee. At the time these original ordinances were pending before the Zoning Neighborhoods and Development Committee, they did not have that same ability. And that was really the genesis of the procedures that were followed, at least in my view, because the Zoning Neighborhoods and Development Committee was able to hold those files in committee and prevent a vote by the full Common Council.
So when you talked about the internal, the council talked about the internal procedure, this was indeed an unusual procedure because, as Justice Babich asked, nothing would have allowed the pulling of the bill or you haven't changed the rules. So at the time this existed, this indeed was a different procedure.
It was. I'm not aware of this.
I'd say unusual, but it certainly wasn't something that was normally done.
It was not something that was normally done, but by the same token, neither was the action of the Zoning Neighborhoods and Development Committee to hold the file at a series of meetings in order to avoid giving the entire Common Council the opportunity to act on the files.
But I can't imagine in the history of the city of Milwaukee that there hadn't been other instances where the committees had held with a majority vote and had this procedure been used before?
I'm sure that it had. In fact, there, in the history of the city that goes back far beyond my involvement, I'm sure that there have been many instances where members of the Common Council have used the political process in order to try and reach their legislative objectives.
Council, even if this is moot, do you want us to address the issues? And if so, under what authority should we do that?
We think it's important for these issues to be addressed because it really clarifies for all Wisconsin municipalities what the requirements are. Our position is that if Section 6223 stats establishes a specific procedure, refer a zoning amendment to the Plan Commission, conduct the Class 2 hearing. Those are mandatory. And the Glauderman v. St. Francis decision made it clear that if you don't follow those specific statutory rules, the action is void. Likewise, if the Constitution or if a municipal charter ordinance establishes requirements, those need to be followed. And given the nature of this decision, it creates confusion among at least municipal attorneys as to when a second Class 2 notice and hearing might be required. Herdman says one referral to the Plan Commission, one Class 2 notice. Unless there's a substantial change, you don't need to reinitiate the whole procedure. This decision focuses on a very small change where you've got identical ordinances and does require that the whole process once again be initiated. Although the Court of Appeals decision did not, interestingly, focus on a referral to the Plan Commission. But certainly a decision by this court would clarify when that process begins. It would clarify the real intent of the decision in Herdman in establishing the substantial change rule. And it could also assist municipalities if this court's decision addresses the claim statute and clarifies under what circumstances plaintiffs bringing action against a municipal entity are going to be required to comply at least with 89381B.
Because let's just double back. What kind of opinion would you write if you were sitting up here on the notice for substantial change or not substantial change? How do you define that, if that's your test?
I think my decision would focus on the Herdman decision, on the adoption by the courts in Wisconsin of the substantial change rule, which is generally consistent in jurisdictions across the country, and would...
So you need new notice if there's a substantial change, is that what you...
Absolutely.
Okay.
But
substantial change is going to be decided on a case-by-case method. Is that right?
It must be decided on a case-by-case basis, but it seems to me that it should also focus on the nature of the development and the impact of the actual zoning change upon the people in the community that are receiving the Class 2 notice.
Okay.
So that if the project changes in a substantial fashion after the initial notice, people in the community should know. If not, a second notice should not be required.
So it will be a change that relates, Council, to the project itself and not the internal maneuvering pursuant to the political process?
Correct. The nature of the project, because it's the project that has an impact on people in the community. If people in the community have concerns about the process and want to make comments about the process, they have the ability to do that. They receive notice of all public meetings, including meetings like the Steering and Rules Committee. It's just that they don't receive Class 2 notice, which requires two insertions. They receive standard Class 1 notice.
Chief?
The thrust of the Court of Appeals opinion, and as I read it, is, look, under our system of government, people have a right to notice. And I agree with you on the substantial requirement standard. The Court of Appeals is saying to you. But look, it's saying, if that's what we're talking about, people needing notice, here, they say, how would a person know that this was going to be heard before the Steering and Rules Committee because it was a matter not within their jurisdiction? How would they figure that out? The Court of Appeals opinion said, thus anyone, the original files were not taken from the committee but left in the zoning committee. So that number two, if anyone were going to check on this, they would say, oh, it's still pending before the zoning committee, you know, if someone were really interested. And then the Court of Appeals said, number three, look, there's only one member on the Steering and Rules Committee that also was a member of the zoning committee. So when people wanted to give a voice, they didn't really have a voice, because there was only, when they showed up, let's say, en masse in the zoning committee, there was only one carryover. And so they really weren't heard. They didn't have an opportunity. How could they have known that this was going to be taken up in full force again? Can you respond to that?
Yes, and I'll try to be brief. First of all, it's fairly common for Milwaukee's Common Council to refer files to more than one committee. So it's not unprecedented to have the Zoning Neighborhoods and Development Committee and some other committee consider a matter. But until the Court of Appeals decision, it's important to note that no one had concluded, other than the plaintiff's appellants, that there was some violation. The Common Council's rules specifically gave the President of the Common Council jurisdiction over assignment of matters to committees. So it created a standard procedure, but it also gave some additional powers to the President of the Common Council. And when the President of the Common Council assigned it to the new committee, notices were sent out. But the notices didn't say, this is an identical file. It simply set forth the title, which was the same title with a different number above it. The people in the community entitled to notice received notice of that Steering and Rules Committee. Finally, whether or not it's the Zoning Neighborhoods and Development Committee, the Steering and Rules Committee, or as permitted by 6223, the City's Plan Commission, once a hearing is held and people from the community have been given an opportunity to present their comments on the nature of the proposed rezoning, that satisfies the statutory requirement. Again, there's not a requirement that the individuals be the same from one meeting to the next. And indeed, the purpose of these hearings is not just to provide information to the members of one committee, but to provide information to the members of the entire Common Council. There's no requirement that all members of the Common Council attend the hearing, but they can certainly review the recommendation of the committee, they can watch the committee meeting on television, they can review a tape of the meeting, so it gives the members of the Common Council the ability to inform themselves as to the comments from the community before they make a final vote.
Is that all right?
Could I ask one minute?
Yes, Dave, just pass.
Sir, when you talk about substantial changes requiring notice, is that only, are those substantial changes only in the committee, or could there be substantial changes before the whole council?
The way I read the Ferdinman decision, the substantial change has to be to the zoning amendment itself. And in that decision, it's recognized that the way the process ideally should function, when a Class 2 notice hearing is conducted and people from the community make comments on the proposed rezoning, the Common Council should have the ability to incorporate at least some of those comments into the ordinance to make changes. But as long as they don't change the fundamental nature of the zoning amendment, as long as they don't change the impact of the project on the people from the community, then the change is not a substantial change, and they don't have to go through the entire process once again. In Herdeman, they made the project, or they made the area to be rezoned smaller, a fairly significant change, especially because it precluded a protest petition. That was deemed not to be a substantial change. In this case, a change in the internal process was deemed to constitute a substantial change, even though the project itself was identical to the prior project. And again, it seems that a substantial change ought to be a change in the project, which will then have a long-term impact on the people in the community who receive the notice and who have the opportunity to say, this is what's happening to my property, address this in your legislative action.
I have one other question. You told us what you view this case is important and should be decided regardless of mootness as to the notice. What about the claim statute? You obviously want some change in the law here.
It's not so much that we're asking for change in the law, but it's our feeling that the Court of Appeals really extended the scope of the Gillen v. Nina case far beyond the opinion in that particular case. Gillen v. Nina said we will create an exception to the claim statute where there's a specific statute that provides injunctive relief. In this case, the only statute that relates in any way to this zoning action is the section of 6223, which permits an injunction against a violation of a zoning ordinance. Here we have a project being built in strict compliance with a zoning ordinance.
So you want the court to say that this case should not be in the court because there wasn't a notice of claims filed here, pursuant to the Waukesha case?
Correct.
Then we never have to reach the other one, the other issue.
Correct.
And why didn't you, why shouldn't we say you waived the claims issue?
We briefed the claims issue in conjunction with our motion to dismiss. When we argued the motion to dismiss in the trial court, the trial court judge asked me whether I felt that our argument on the claim statute was weak, because I focused on the substantive zoning issues in this case. I probably did not give him a complete answer, because I said, no, I don't believe that claims statute argument is weak. I think it's dispositive. However, as long as we're all here, the substantive issues relating to the zoning ought also to be addressed. We did not waive that issue, but if that had been the sole issue decided by the trial court at the motion to dismiss phase, then it would have simply delayed the process until a notice of claim could be filed, and in fact one had been filed after our motion, and they would have filed a new action and we would have initiated the whole process all over again. So at that point, it really would have resulted only in delay if the trial court had decided exclusively on the claim statute. Unfortunately, the decision of the trial court at the motion to dismiss level never mentioned the claim statute, and so we didn't have a specific determination at that point.
Is that argument waivable in the first place? Is notice of claim waivable or jurisdictional?
In our brief, we took the position that it was not. There's a distinction between 893-81A, which is the notice of injury statute, which can be waived if there's notice, if there's no prejudice, but there's a different body of case law construing 1A and 1B. And there is case law, which we cited in our brief, indicating that the filing of a notice of claim under 893-81B is not something which a municipality can waive. And in any event, we did not waive it in this case because we raised it in the trial court, we raised and briefed it in the Court of Appeals, and we made an issue of that notice of claim statute at each point in the litigation.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you. please the court, my name is Joseph Sincott. I represent Rosemary Olivera and Sean Smart, two neighbors or nearby residents of a group called the Humboldt Yards Coalition that live very near this development. Let me go to this 893 issue since it's right in front of us. What the city attorney just mentioned was, well, let's take it up, Judge Cece, at the circuit court, because otherwise we're going to have to wait 4 months and then do it again. Well, to me, then, the whole point of the notice procedure is to allow the city to look at this again and possibly resolve it. Implied in that statement is that it's not going to get resolved. We're just going to wait 4 months, and then you can sue again. So clearly, it would have been futile for us to file that notice of claim because they weren't going to change their mind. So I think that provides a basis, a public policy way, to say that 89380 as a whole does not apply. In addition, 6223, the zoning enabling statute, under its enforcement and remedies sections, is very much like the Gillen provision. The Gillen provision under Chapter 30.294 allowed for injunctive relief. Because that was a more specific provision, this court said, I think wisely, that, well, neighbors, citizens that are suing need to be able to move forward. 6223, I think, provides a very analogous situation. And it does deal with relief that is prior to the building going up. Now, there's this argument that, well, the zoning that was passed was legal, and you needed a declaratory judgment action first. And so, therefore, there is no statute that gets you out of 89380. I think the Gillen case is actually very similar. In that case, you had the city and a private party and DNR agreeing to a contract, a lease, and the plaintiffs in that case brought a declaratory judgment first in conjunction with their injunctive request. So the analogy, I think, is very strong under 89380, that it does not apply and should not apply in this kind of situation.
Counsel, is the Gillen situation different because the public trust doctrine was involved?
I don't think so. I think the public trust doctrine, the analogy there is 6223. I mean, the public trust doctrine is in some ways like a super zoning law. It's just another standard by which people can have impact on their surroundings.
So you think the injunctive relief remedy is the key as far as our reading of Gillen?
I think that's right in this case. But incorporated into that is the necessary requirement that you be able to declare what's wrong first or in conjunction with that injunctive relief. Now, if I can go back to the discussion on the procedural actions in the city. And let me say first, the thing I want to have us think about is, what if this was a American Storage, Drew Lasko and the residents on this side? I mean, that very much could be the case. I mean, these notice of claim provisions in the zoning enabling statute are there for the property owner, the proponent, and the nearby residents. So I think this case is quite important. The notice of claim issue may be important, but I think the 6223 rulings are very important to clarify the law. I don't see that this court has really addressed this issue in quite some time, if at all. But let me go back to the procedures in the council. Justice Wilcox, you discussed a hold to the call of the chair versus this sort of unorthodox new procedure that, well, we're going to create new files and put them over its steering and rules. In fact, and I have it here, in the appendix to our Court of Appeals brief in the record, and I don't have it in my brief here, but I'm going to cite it anyway. In 1996, this property at Humboldt Yards came up with the council under file number 960830. President Colwitz actually happened to be on the ZND at that time and voted twice during what was a multi-month period to hold that decision to the call of the chair. And the decision was, do we rezone Humboldt Yards? Same thing. So we had twice where the president himself was holding to the call of the chair. The point being, that is a more common procedure and is, in fact, I think, explicitly allowed for in the procedural rules. The procedure that was implemented, or let me put it this way, the actions taken by the city the actions taken by the city in implementing 6223's mandates can be reviewed by the courts and were unique, as far as I can tell, in looking through all the history I could in this situation. I have never found another situation where duplicate or new files were created and a new committee took them over. And this gets into this idea that 11-4 vote at the end of the process should pretty much wipe away all these issues, because there it was, and the language from the Stitt case, which is heavily relied on, discusses it as an implied repealer. So maybe we didn't follow our procedural rules exactly, but we had an 11-4 vote, so 11 council people basically thought, well, that's okay. We'll incorporate that decision into the substantive decision on the zoning. That's a problem. It's a real problem. I think the term is smuggling. I mean, you're putting in a very important decision about how you're going to administer the zoning statute, which is going to have significant effects on how people testify, where they go to lobby. You're putting that procedural decision, you're letting them smuggle that in and not be taken up fully at the full council. The full council is going to vote on this like a conference committee report. They're not going to amend it at the full council. They're going to get the expertise from the committee, the recommendation, and then they're going to vote it up and down. And if I can suggest, I think that's why President Kaulitz did that. He wanted the committee imprimatur, if you will, of a review, and then kick it up to the council, and now, under our rules, well, we can't change it, so let's do something out there, and we'll pass the bigger store. Okay, so the procedural changes had a massive substantive impact. At the ZND, under the longstanding procedures, three and then four people said, let's hold it, let's negotiate, let's get a smaller store. So the folks are happy. They're like, okay, we're going to get a smaller store. Some wanted nothing. Maybe that's not reasonable, but let's get a smaller store. Then this new process comes in and it's totally changed. They're very prejudiced. Under this Herdman case, we talk about affecting rights. You went from winning essentially a victory of a smaller store that's going to come out of ZND, and as Alderman D'Amato says, the council is going to vote for any reasonable project here. So ZND, the experts, are saying, we're listening to the people, we want a smaller store. That victory is essentially there, gets completely reversed in steering and rules.
Well, now how are they hurt? What's the difference? Was there a notice for the steering committee?
There was open meetings notice, I think. Okay. There was not, as Judge Fine said, full Class 2 notice for this zoning change. And what Judge Fine did, I think, and what Judge Sykes perhaps picked up on was Herdman doesn't apply. Herdman deals with maybe a substantive change. If it does apply, as I've tried to draw it in my brief, it could also apply to this kind of a change. And that would be for the courts to decide. I think it's clear that in that case, in Herdman, the judge made this de minimis decision, that there was a de minimis change not requiring full notice under 6223. What we'd argue is either Herdman doesn't apply because it deals with Judge Fine took the city at its word. These were new files. This was a new attempt to amend 6223. And that's the key word in 6223, proposed amendments. And really what this court has to do is interpret that statute, how far or how narrowly. Pardon?
What was amended? I thought these were duplicate files in all respects.
Substantively, they were. But the city made a choice to call them something new and put them in a new committee. I mean, obviously, to me, the reasons are because then they can get things through the process in a way they want to get them through. I think if they're gonna do that and confuse the public, and 6223 is set up to protect not only the proponent but the public, that's very clear under Glaudeman, under the Levitt case, under Bueller. Judge Curry makes comments to that effect. Very concerned about zoning affects the entire city, so. You provide that notice for the entire city, and I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, Justice Babich. Okay.
Go ahead.
I want to pursue the right to people to be heard. Changing the facts a little in this case, let's say it was a zoning issue and there was a notice pursuant to 6223 and said, and it was a hotly contested issue. And the notice said, okay, all of you people line up, you're all hot about this, line up, and you're going to say anything and everything you want in front of the playgrounds committee. Now, that's changing the facts here a bit, in that we have one member on the zoning committee that was on the steering committee that made the decision. But in my hypothetical, the playgrounds committee is not going to make a decision on the zoning, but the zoning committee is, okay? To me, that seems a bit hollow as to the right to be heard. You can vent all you want. You can bring all the expert testimony in, because both you and your opposing counsel suggested in your comments, and maybe I took it too literally, that the counsel then listens to the expertise from the recommending committee, and then they vote up and down, and your opposing counsel said something about they have the right to listen to the testimony from the recommending committee or look at the notes of the recommending committee. But if nothing, in my hypothetical, if nothing is presented to the zoning committee, then that also is hollow. What's wrong with that argument, or what's wrong with that approach, or what am I missing? Maybe the wrong person to ask.
Yeah, I know. I think it's the right approach. Let me give you this perspective. You know, the folks that I am helping out here, some of them are very involved in city government, others are not. As you read the commentary on zoning law and some of the cases, you see the references to what's pretty obvious. Let's have a predictable process to establish accuracy and fairness. People need confidence that that's happening. And that's not a license for the courts to go in and start to become parliamentarians in every context. But in the zoning context, let's make sure that these people are making these decisions in a way that's inspiring and allowing people to feel like their government's representing them. And I'll tell you, if you go to playgrounds, that's sort of fairly obvious that, you know, we're not getting the respect we deserve under this situation. We'd like to talk to the people that are going to make the decision. So, to me, it's just sort of an obvious public policy matter that municipal decisions, but zoning in particular, which affects the neighbors, they want to have an impact. Allow them to have the impact at the committee that the city itself says is going to make the decision. And that's what happened in this case, and we won. I mean, we won the debate. Essentially, hold it, negotiate, reduce the size. The basic response is that it's just fundamentally unfair.
Now, the zoning committee had this and held it over, right?
Yeah.
Suppose that, and I assume that you would then have to keep watching that zoning committee to make sure it didn't bring it up again. Because if it brought it up again, you would not need another notice. Is that right?
That's what I think. Yeah, that's why I think Herdman applies.
Pardon me?
That's where the Herdman case would apply.
So you would not need another notice. They could just bring it up again.
Well, you need open meetings notice.
Okay.
You know.
That's what I'm getting at.
Yeah.
So you would be watching them, I would assume, very carefully to make sure that you would be present if it was brought up again.
I would think that people who were interested would be
exactly
aware, and they would check the open
meeting. And
they
don't need another notice, just the open meeting. Now, was there anything in the open meeting or in the files of ZNR to show that this had now been, a duplicate copy had been moved to another committee?
You know, actually I have the agenda from the steering rules committee.
Well, but you wouldn't have been watching the steering rules. You would have been watching the ZNR.
Oh, the ZND, right.
ZND,
sorry. Oh, no. I don't know that it's in the record, but there was nothing that I remember. I don't I don't think there was anything noticed that.
So what was
it? C&D wasn't having a meeting, so there was no notice, no agenda.
So what about SNR? Was that the Steering and Rules Committee? You were going to tell us there was some public notice.
Right. I mean, it's not part of the record, although it's a public document. And there's a notice, and it's the two file, the new numbers, and it talks about rezoning of Humboldt Yards.
Okay.
So.
Thank you.
So we're really not talking about whether you get notice or don't get notice. It's what sort of notice you get.
Well, I think the people that were vigilant got some notice. They got mailed notice, and they got open meetings notice. But the zoning statute, for a long time, has required this multi-week preparatory notice. Because zoning is very important. It's more important than general legislation. I think that's fairly obvious based on the strictures in 6223. And the other side of that is this. This court, I don't think, has commented on whether the notice and hearing provisions in 6223 have to be strictly enforced. The Glaudeman decision clearly does that. The notice was a little late, and that they voided the ordinance. And yet there's no discussion of whether the people were there or not, the ones that were mainly opposed. But the important thing is that this provision has to be a rule and a standard for the city to follow, not just, well, they got enough notice, so it was complied with. I think that's too loose a standard. 6223 is a mandatory statute based on the Scanlon versus Menasha discussion by this court. Should be enforced strictly, and the reason why is because if you go back and you say, well, you didn't provide a proper notice and we're prejudiced, well, then prove that. Well, you know, you elected officials were there. If more people would have been there, you would have changed your minds. Well, no, I wouldn't, because I already voted one way. You can't expect them now to say, oh, yeah, if you got more people out there with better notice, I would have changed my mind. I think that's not, no one's going to be able to prove that kind of prejudice. So you've got to enforce it strictly. And this the thing about that is, it's the proponent of the zoning, the citizens against the state, the city, enforcing neutral rules strictly. It doesn't get the court into substantive decision-making. And this gets into the separation of powers question. This court is enforcing, doing a statutory interpretation of 6223. You can interpret it very loosely to the benefit of cities, or more strictly. And I think when you do that, we think you shouldn't interpret it strictly and include the word amendment to mean, you know what, follow the longstanding process when you change zoning. That's what amendment means. That's a legal interpretation of that statute, and this court and the Court of Appeals certainly empowered to do that. Based on the undisputed facts, you can say amendment means a new process, new files from the city means new amendment means new notice. By enforcing it strictly, you level the playing field between opponents of development, the citizens who might be opposed or in favor, versus the state or the city who's regulating. So it's a neutral application of procedural rules. It's not a substantive decision by the judiciary.
Is there a clear reason why the city didn't publish the second notice?
I think there was. I'm not sure. I mean, I could say that there wasn't enough time, I don't think. I mean, I think there ended up being enough time, but they didn't get it done. I mean, they introduced the file. President Kollwitz, again, he unilaterally introduced this file on Thursday, the 26th of February, I believe. And I think the standard is to wait until there's a council meeting and actually introduce them. But he introduced it, and then he referred it to his committee. And then the hearing was April 1st, so there would have been time to do the class two. But it didn't get done. But they mailed notice, and they say at some point prior, and apparently that was lost, you know, exactly when that happened. Some of the folks involved in our effort did not get that notice. There's some affidavits in the record from them.
Now, even if you win up here, I'm sorry,
that's it.
Even if you win up here, what do you get? I mean, ultimately, in the short run and long run.
Okay. You get something very important, and I think, and again, I'm going to refer to a case that I brought up in the letter brief to the Court of Appeals on mootness, the Batke decision about open meetings law. You instruct, and perhaps this is, you know, downward looking at municipalities. It doesn't have to be that way. The court needs to clarify the law and to determine whether the actions taken by a city were legal under, in that case, open meetings, in this case, 6223. So to me, and again to my plaintiffs and the citizens, that's crucially important. That's what this court in some ways should do. They should say, you know, this is where, this is how this should be done so that in the future developers and citizens will know. In the long run, I think this decision will clarify the law and will perhaps provide some basis for challenging, for instance, if you introduce files in February of 1 year, and then you wait 2 years, you have a couple hearings on them that are properly noticed, and you wait 2 years, and then you have another hearing on them, and then one of the members of that committee changes his vote, and then it gets kicked up to the council. But that second hearing, that third hearing, in this case, you have initial notice, two hearings, 2 years, and about 2 months later, let's say, a new hearing happens. It's open meeting noticed, but it's not class two noticed under zoning. They make a zoning change, goes to the full council, gets passed. To me, again, 6223 would not allow that kind of city action. Initial notice and hearing, then let's put it aside for 2 years, and that's just bringing it up again without a full class two notice. So in that case, this decision would, I think, allow a challenge to that type of action.
That's what I was going to ask you. I mean, this is a very peculiar situation of moving it to a different committee. You got dozens of municipalities out there, and these rules, some of them affect only Milwaukee. But so how would you write this? Would you say you got to hear it immediately? It's got to be held, the hearing has to be held within the period for the next election for the city council? I mean, what rule do you write here that is a broader impact than you just can't change committees? Or maybe that's enough. If you change committees, you got to give a new hearing. Is that the kind of rule you want? You think this court should adopt in interpreting 6223.7d2?
Yeah, I think the amendment in that statute, proposed amendment means, in our view, either follow the process that exists and do it reasonably. And in saying that, it means the court gets to look at that. The court gets to look at that reasonable process. So
follow the process the city has set up. Okay. All right.
Right. Because it engenders a bit more expert review of zoning.
Okay, but that doesn't cover your 3-year principle.
Oh, no, and it guarantees due process.
Well, the city doesn't have any rule about how long it can be held in committee. Let's just assume that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's held there for 3, 4, 5 years, and then all of a sudden it's dusted off and comes up. Where does it say a time period in 6223.7d2?
It just talks about prior to having the hearing, the time period. It doesn't say how long from... there is some reference to time periods, however. If the committee holds that zoning for, I think, 90 days, then the council can pull it up automatically in another provision. I think you could incorporate that kind of a standard perhaps into a reasonable standard for what a city can do.
I thought it dies after 90 days.
No, I think they can, well, that's...
Isn't it deemed denied if it's not acted on?
It's deemed denied.
Right, so...
Maybe it's 60
days.
Right.
Two separate provisions. There's a city ordinance that deems it died, and there's a provision in state statutes.
Right. So this 2-3 year scenario can never occur. Right. It just dies the natural death after 90 days. So everybody is working against the clock here, and that's part of the problem.
Well, that's an interesting point. I didn't actually think about that. That could be, in fact, another argument.
That's
a city-based ordinance, so I don't think that would be the statute that would provide that remedy. That would be the city ordinance that allows, that requires this as it dies. It's not forwarded by the Plan Commission in 90 days. I think the city ordinance said it's denied. I don't know if the state statute allows that or requires or has a rule on that. I guess the basic point would be, you know, it's got to be reasonable in the same way that substantial change is a legal determination. In some ways that might apply in this case to say, well, maybe as I've said in my brief, substantial change in substance as well as substantial change in the fundamental fairness of passing this thing. And it might be a laches standard. I mean, maybe you have to show some prejudice over time. If it's only a few months and it's still vital and in the news, that you have a burden as a citizen or a developer to say, you know, we need new hearing and notice.
Council, I have I'm somewhat confused as to the issues that you believe are presented by this case. Let me see if I can clarify it with this question. Assume for the moment that we decide against you on the notice requirement. Assume that this court, a majority of this court, says that all that was required was that notice for the ZND hearings, and they have now complied with the statute. Do we still then have a separation of powers issue before us? Do we still have that procedural issue before us that we must resolve? And if so, how would you state that issue?
I'm not sure I understand. In our complaint, the second amendment complaint, I think we make a separate claim that procedural due process was violated by the not following city rules, separate from the notice claim. So I think that is in there. The Court of Appeals didn't address that one, I don't think, directly. I think the court can safely say, yeah, you should, in the zoning context, maybe 6223 says the city will give fair process. It doesn't say anything about fair notice or specifics.
So it's a due process claim that you would be pursuing.
There is, yeah. And we okay, would
and what,
due process.
And what are those procedures that you say were violated, aside from the giving of notice, because we've already decided that they only have to give one notice?
Okay.
I mean, we haven't decided that in my hypothetical.
Yeah.
Taking it to the steering
There's no provision at all. In fact, it's arbitrary, it seems to me, to call something a duplicate file. There's no provision for that. There's specifics in the procedure that talk about files. A new file shall be referred to the committee with appropriate subject matter jurisdiction. That was not followed at all. It was flouted, it seems to me. So that's the main problem. This unilateral introduction of a completely unorthodox and uncalled for an uncountenanced file on an ordinance. Then you've got two subject matters of identical nature at the council at one time. I think there's another provision that says that that's not proper. And again, it's there, I think, to avoid this kind of situation. So I would say what I would ask for is, in zoning legislation, the Scanlon Court principle should be applied and say a city picks a process. If they pick it, they got to follow it. And if they don't, the developer and the citizens are not afforded adequate process under the state constitution or 6223, which I think are somewhat equivalent. So I think that's a strong rule. It's a clear rule. It adds some concern to Mr. Gartner and his fellow city attorneys. Boy, you better follow the rules. But in this case, they could have had. And let me get to this point. The jurisdictional question, or the common council president has jurisdictional discretion to assign anything anywhere. I don't think that's quite right. But as far as discharging this thing from a recalcitrant committee, there was no rule that said they couldn't go to the common council and vote by majority to do that. Now they've put one in, it's more explicit. But they certainly could have done that. So if it's a town and they don't have a lot of formal rules, well then you got to look at the actions they took. If it's a sophisticated city that styles itself as kind of a mini legislature, and it's dealing with individualized property rights, and not just like stit when you're looking to redo the legislative argument, but you're affecting people's property, make them follow the rules specifically. That would be, I think, the broad reach of 6223 and the due process clause in the state constitution.
What's the primary purpose of the Common Council's internal operating rules?
Well, they have a preamble, I mean, that says to ensure democracy and fair and full hearing, as well as some other things, and I don't want to minimize that. They can correct me on that. But to me, it is, those are ministerial duties. I mean, if you're a developer and you're confronted with a longstanding process and then you don't get it, I think you're going to get a mandamus and say, wait a minute, do this. This says you have to do this, do it. That's due process.
Your position is that the internal operating rules of the Common Council confer some sort of process rights on the citizenry?
I think that people that have property rights in their property, when a city is going to impact that through zoning, the city procedural rules become due process. Yes. I think that that's right. I don't think you have to go that far to decide this case and affirm Judge Fine. I think he ruled 6023. This was a new amendment because it was a new file. It took the city at its word.
Well, he did.
Our other claim says, yeah, we were, and it's a good faith due process. You don't have to say, well, they intentionally messed things up and it was a sham. I think that is due process. If you're a developer and the city is dragging its feet and they're intentionally screwing you up, that's a due process violation. I'm saying, in this context, the rules should be the standard, and if they're not properly followed, then go back and do it again or change the rules. The separation of powers question is minimized because it's a rule-enforcing decision by you, not a change the substantive zoning, which is not what we're asking for here. We would have been happy to have the ZND decide, finally, on a smaller store. But I'm saying that in the other claim that's embedded in our Second Amendment complaint is essentially kind of a good faith, this is a good faith or a negligent due process violation, procedural due process violation. There are procedures that are set up. It seems to me that that's self-defining almost as a duty, a ministerial duty that requires you to follow through and follow those procedures. And that would require the courts to look at those and make a reasonable interpretation of them to ensure that that happened. My time is up. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We now have 2.5 minutes by you, Mr. Weber.
Thank you. Just 3 points. One, the consequences of what we're talking about today. Two, responses to some of Justice Bradley's concerns about the procedures. And then finally, just a quick fact about this particular project. With respect to the consequences, counsel's right. I mean, the roles could be reversed. It could be American Stores on the other side or the developer on the other side the next time. And think about what they're proposing. While we have this body of case law that says courts are deferential to the outcomes of zoning, such that you have to meet this arbitrary and capricious standard, because we're going to respect how these elected representatives decide what the appropriate use of land is, because we have that body of law. Now there's a proposal to have a body of law that says, yes, but as to each internal operating step that those elected representatives follow as they're discharging their duty, then I get to sue about each one of those. And as a lawyer for clients that have resources to sue, that would be a bonanza. And we would have so much more litigation over zoning issues. Again, the courts would be deciding all these issues, not our elected representatives. That's exactly the opposite of what is supposed to work.
What about his argument that, look, here, the procedural changes had a massive substantive change. In other words, because you're dealing with property rights, and this was a hotly contested right. matter, right. but this procedure that you yourself said, and some counsel said it hadn't, was not a familiar procedure, and the opposing counsel said he went back and he hadn't seen it used before, but it made a big difference as far as under Herdman of substantive changes. What about just that narrow area?
Let's remember what kind of procedures we're talking about and for whose benefit they are. Okay. The internal operating procedures are the way this group of elected officials is. Here's how we're going to run our business. And so if an alderman came forward and said, wait a minute, my rights to how, as an alderman, to participate in this process are being affected, that would be different. These are not procedural due process rights for people who live in that area. It's how does this group discharge its business? So these words like process and due process are slippery and need to be understood in a particular context. If I could just respond to Justice Bradley, you know, the way this institution operates its business is quite different. You know, I know that when a justice was appointed right before your term began, the sheriff drove over with briefs so that that justice could participate right away in the oral arguments, so that you'd have 7 votes for something, because everybody wants to participate in the decisions. Elected representatives, the legislative body, of course, is different, and they have committees that look at different issues, and those committees are not the ones, not like this court, that decide. And there's a Wisconsin Attorney General opinion that says explicitly that, we cited at page 18 of our brief, it is clear that such hearing need not be before the legislative body, which will ultimately adopt, approve, or reject the proposed zoning. So you can have a hearing before the Plan Commission, and yet it's the Common Council that decides. So your questions about, well, there's only one member carryover, it's different. It's not like this court. And as to the question, the many questions about, well, but the substantive change and so on, again at page 18 of our brief, we point out the very, I think, appropriate common sense approach that the Herdman Court took. If the initial notice is broad enough to encompass the proposed changes, an additional public hearing ordinarily will not be required. To require a new notice and public hearing for each proposed change, no matter how small, would heavily burden the legislative process. And again, the point that I made earlier, then what happens is everything is a way station to get to the court. And we litigators look for any procedural trip up that the legislative bodies make so that then we can go into court and try to achieve our result. Finally, the factual issue. This property, as we noted in the brief, actually had been zoned previously for the same kind of development. It had to be rezoned because of the particular planned unit development, but we were talking about the existing zoning requiring a bigger development than ultimately was built. The rezoning actually was a downsizing. So this was not a change from wilderness to a grocery store.
Well, it may have been, but that's not the issue. Mr. Gartner, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Trevor, who gives notice under D2? Is it the city council or the particular committee?
The city clerk is responsible for giving notices under D2, so the city clerk's office would give notices, whether it was any committee of the Common Council or the full Common Council itself. In fact, I believe the city clerk also would handle those notices if the hearings were to be conducted before the Plan Commission.
D2 talks about the council, so not particularly a committee. What about the last sentence in D2? If the council doesn't receive recommendations from the Plan Commission, and this was sent to the Plan Commission too, right?
Yes.
Or Plan Committee. It doesn't talk about the Zoning Committee. Is that the Plan Committee for Milwaukee?
As a first-class city, Milwaukee has a Plan Commission. I believe that some other municipal bodies have a Plan Committee, or in some cases in counties, I believe that the entire board would serve that function.
Okay, but here you had a Plan Commission and you had the ZM Committee.
Correct.
And then it says if the council doesn't receive recommendations within 60 days, the council may hold hearings without receiving the recommendations. This all extended over 60 days.
The way I read that last sentence, the statute requires 2 things. It requires a zoning amendment to be referred to the Plan Commission for cities or Plan Committee for other jurisdictions, or it says reported recommendation.
Right.
If the common, pardon?
After the notice.
No, that reported recommendation from the Plan Commission is separate and distinct from the one public hearing conducted pursuant to Class 2 notice. So typically what will happen is that when a file is introduced, the zoning amendment is referred to the Plan Commission. They will conduct their own public hearing, not pursuant to Class 2 notice, and make a report back to the Common Council saying, we recommend approval, we recommend disapproval.
The last sentence of that statute says, the plan commission cannot pocket veto by refusing to make a recommendation. If the plan commission doesn't act within 60 days...
Doesn't cover this committee.
Doesn't cover this committee.
Where is this committee noticed at all in D? That's my really the point of my question. I don't see this committee anywhere in D.
It is not referenced. In fact, there's no requirement in the statutes that Milwaukee's Common Council even have committees.
That's right.
They could operate and conduct all the city's business as a committee of the whole. I suspect that in many jurisdictions in the state, the same type of committee structure that Milwaukee has simply does not exist.
Okay, so suppose they had operated as a whole. They got the plan commission back, the recommendation back. Do you need another notice here?
At some point, you still need to have class 2 notice and one hearing. But you would not need, you would not, once that class 2 notice has been given, the normal public notice of a meeting is all that's required for future meetings.
That's my point. Under D2, if you look at it, it doesn't say who gives the hearing. It's the council provides the notice. And then that may be an issue of why would you need two notices? Because it's all through the council, regardless of how the council sets it up. Anyway, suggest.
Thank you.
I've taken up all your time. Justice Bradley will continue that tradition.
That's taking up all your time. I have a question regarding the notice of claim provision.
Yes.
Last year, this court, I think it was last year, issued an opinion, Willow Creek.
Yes.
And there was, as we say in the business, a vigorous dissent in that case, and a well-reasoned dissent. And that dissent attacked the 89380 sub-4, which dealt with immunity, and the Johnson case, and said, oh, Johnson is overly broad. And apparently that was convincing to the majority, because the majority said in its opinion, we agree with the dissent that Johnson is overly broad. And Johnson, we said, thus the Johnson court essentially addressed the applicability of sub 84 to injunctive relief, and this is important, based on tort, concluding that the municipal assertion of immunity barred such relief. To the extent that the language in Johnson suggests otherwise, by expanding immunity too broadly, we limit the language. So we limited Johnson just to injunctive relief based on tort. Johnson, of course, is based on City of Waukesha. Decided 2 years after City of Waukesha, City of Waukesha was a 80 sub 1 claim that was the notice of claim, just like we have here, and Johnson said, okay, the rationale for the notice of the claim is the same as the rationale of the immunity under sub 4. Consistent with the majority and dissent in Willow Creek, doesn't it seem that the notice of claim here should be limited to injunctive relief based on tort?
I don't believe so. In the Willow Creek decision, the dissenting opinion very carefully distinguished between 89381B, where the legislature said no action may be brought or maintained. And that deals with the notice of claim statute. In sub 4, the statutory language is quite different. It specifically references torts, and it specifically references legislative action in saying there will be immunity for certain types of actions. And in that decision, it was clear that the declaratory relief remedy was not encompassed by the immunity statute. So in other words, it was still possible to bring an action seeking declaratory relief for
focusing on either a tort or, I think more typically, legislative action, there would not be immunity.
This injunction tied, the causes of action were declaratory and injunctive, and that was it. This injunction here and declaratory action here are not in any way based on tort, are they?
No, they are not. This action sought a declaration that the zoning ordinance was invalid, and it sought injunctive relief generally. There was no mention in the second amended complaint of an injunction pursuant to Section 6223 stats. In fact, in our brief, we've contended that there was no specific statutory provision in this action that formed the basis for an injunction. And that's the real distinction that we believe the court should focus upon. The decision in the Gillen case said, because this entire area of the claim statute is somewhat, I'm not sure that the term used may have been muddled, we're going to focus our exceptions very narrowly. And in the Gillen case, the decision created exceptions for injunctive relief where a specific statutory provision gave rise to that injunctive relief. The concurring opinion in Gillen's indicated that if the court's main decision had forthrightly held that it was applicable to all injunctive relief, there would have been no concurring opinion. And that's really what the Court of Appeals has done in this case. They've gone far beyond Gillen, which says where there is a specific statutory injunctive provision, we'll create an exception. And in effect, the Court of Appeals in this case has extended Gillen to say anywhere there's a request for an injunction, the claim statute does not apply. And if that's the holding, it means that in virtually all cases, 893.81b will not apply because it's very simple to seek some form of injunctive relief in conjunction with just about any action. And so our position on the Court of Appeals decision in this case is that it really extends Gillen far beyond the actual decision in Gillen and far beyond what the legislature ever intended when it said in 893.81b, no action shall be brought or maintained. Thank you.
Counsel, thank you. That concludes our proceeding on 98-2474 Olivera versus the City of Milwaukee. Thank you. Would counsel approach the bench, please? Friendly.